morning, and I want to welcome today the Madison Baptist School. And who's here from the Madison Baptist School? And your students are? Well, welcome to you all. Why don't you stand? That's good. Thank you. And we have River Ridge Middle School, Bloomington. There are 10 students. Would you all stand? Good. Well, welcome to you all, too. Won't you be seated? And now that you have been introduced to the court, I would like to introduce the court to all of you and everyone else in the courtroom. And I'll start with, on the far left, Justice Patrick Brooks, and to his right, Justice Janine Geske, and to my immediate left, Justice William Babbage. And I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. And to my right is Justice Don Steinmetz. And to his right, Justice John Wilcox. And to his right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I hope all the students have gotten the photographs of the court, which will describe the justices and give you some information about the court, as well as summaries of the cases that you are about, the case you are about to hear. So with that, we will now call the case 96-1973 CR, the State versus Alexander, and Dennis Malowski. You are the attorney for Mr. Alexander. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
You may do so.
Madam Chief Justice, Associate Justices, Mr. Balistrieri, my name is Dennis Malowski. I'm from the law offices of Barry S. Cohen in Elkhart Lake, and I represent Mr. Alexander in this matter. The issue that is before the court today is whether the defendant can, in a third or subsequent criminal OWI prosecution, override the prosecutor's refusal to consent to a jury waiver on the prior offense element of the prohibited alcohol concentration charge. Or, stated differently, can the trial court give effect to a defendant's unilateral jury waiver of the prior offense element of the prohibited alcohol concentration charge in a third or subsequent criminal OWI prosecution? It is well settled that the existence of prior offenses in the context of Section 346.631B is an element of that offense under State versus Ludeking. Since the fact of the prior offenses is an element of the offense, a stipulation to remove it from the jury's consideration requires with it a partial jury waiver of that element. A stipulation in and of itself, without the accompanying jury waiver, simply dispenses with the need for the prosecutor to provide additional proof to the jury of that particular element. With only a stipulation and no partial jury waiver, the element is still submitted to the jury, and they must determine whether or not the driver's record is in accordance with the judge's instruction.
How would this work? I'm sorry to interrupt you so early in your argument, but I need to understand how this would work in practice if you were to prevail. There are three elements to this offense. Would the jury be instructed as to the second element?
Here's what they would be instructed. Simply this. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the second offense charges the defendant with a prohibited alcohol concentration. The applicable alcohol concentration to the defendant in this case is 0.08. You must use that alcohol concentration in assessing the defendant's guilt or innocence with respect to this charge. That's all they need to be told. It dispenses with the need altogether of getting into the technical language of the jury instructions as it now reads, which is, ladies and gentlemen, you have been told that the defendant has two or more prior convictions that would be counted under Section 343.307 sub 1.
So what would the jury be? The jury would be told then that there are only two elements to the offense?
Well, in essence, it would dispense with the element requiring that they find...
I'm not asking in essence. I'm asking in practical terms.
It would eliminate that element. It would eliminate the necessity of the jury's finding that the defendant has two or more prior convictions under 343-307.
So the jury would, in practical terms, be told there are only two elements that you must find in order to convict this defendant.
That the defendant had been operating a motor vehicle, and the defendant had a prohibited alcohol concentration, and the prohibited alcohol concentration applicable to this defendant is .08. That's it. That's the extent of it.
Since you're on that point, would you address Mr. Ballastori's point that jurors will know as a practical matter that it's usually .10? I mean, that we all, as common experience, knows that. How can a court address that, or should it? If it's not going to do the conviction thing.
Well, I think there are several reasons why that concern shouldn't be a concern. First of all, there are numerous different prohibited alcohol concentrations in the state of Wisconsin. There's the .10 standard, which I wouldn't be too quick to concede that most people are familiar with. In my experience practicing exclusively in this field, a lot of jurors simply don't know what the applicable alcohol level is. But aside from that, there are many different alcohol concentrations in Wisconsin. There's the .08 standard for third and subsequent offenders. There's the .10 standard for the majority of accused drunk drivers if it's their first or second offense. There's the .04 alcohol concentration for certain commercial drivers. There's the .00 or absolute sobriety requirement for other commercial drivers. Then there's the .00 or absolute sobriety requirement for those individuals under the age of 21. The jurors, since there are so many different alcohol concentrations, I don't know that the jurors are going to necessarily be sitting in the back of the jury room questioning why this gentleman is facing...
Let me ask you, is that something that is usually handled on voir dire with prospective jurors? Their knowledge of alcohol levels and what they ought to use in terms of deciding the case?
Well, it depends. It depends whether the trial court has granted our motion to eliminate this finding from the jury. If it's something that we have to deal with, or...
But I'm talking on a usual case. I mean, is that something that comes up during voir dire, what prospective jurors think may be the law in terms of OWI?
It does, and to be honest with you, most of the times when it is addressed, I've found that trial court judges are quick to cut either the prosecutor off or the defendant off and explain to the jury that, look, it doesn't matter what you bring into this courtroom, we're telling you that the applicable alcohol limit in this particular case is .08 or .10 or whatever the case may be. Knowing that jurors have to follow the law, we can rest easy with that situation.
Thank you.
And what standard of law, if we were to write it the way you say it, to write the case the way you want us to, would we say that this was a constitutional right of the defendant, or would we base it on?
I don't know that it can be couched in terms of being a constitutional right. The Wisconsin Court of Appeals addressed the issue of whether or not the defendant has a constitutional right to a full jury waiver, as did the United States Supreme Court. The Wisconsin Court of Appeals was State versus Cook, COOK. The United States Supreme Court that addressed that very issue was Singer versus the United States. Both courts found that there is no constitutional right for the defendant to waive a jury trial without the consent of the state.
So what would we say, just prejudicial?
Exactly. And that's where the case of Old Chief versus the United States comes into play. Because when you read Old Chief, although it's not technically on point with the issue at hand here, because Old Chief had to do with the compulsion of the prosecutor to accept a stipulation to prior bad act evidence in status crime cases, the language and reasoning of Old Chief can logically be extended to this situation because their reasoning was couched in terms of a 403 balancing test. They looked at basically two issues, did the Old Chief court. First, what is the extent of the potential prejudice of the prior bad act evidence? The Old Chief Court was particularly concerned and, in fact, described it as especially obvious in the context of cases where the prior bad acts are similar to the offense charged in the overlying criminal offense.
But even in Old Chief, Justice Souter said that the jury was allowed to hear only so much as to know that the conviction admitted by the defendant falls within the class of crimes that Congress, or in our case the legislature, thought should bar a convict from possessing a gun. So what's wrong with telling them that so long as what you say does not implicate a drunken driving, or does not name the nature or the name of the crime, but simply that he's been convicted, what's wrong with that?
Well, there are several problems with that. First of all, the Supreme Court was not presented with the issue that we're addressing here, whether the next step can occur. Not only that the prosecutor has to stipulate to the existence of the prior offense and can't get into the substance and nature of the offense, but whether or not the prosecutor can be prohibited at all from introducing any evidence of the prior offense element. The reason why that's a problem, Your Honor, and quite honestly, I can't explain why Old Chief's attorney wouldn't have taken that next step, because in my estimation, it really does us no good to stipulate out the substance of the offense.
But in Old Chief, Souter said it was okay to tell him that there was a conviction, so long as you didn't name the nature and the name.
Well, only because Justice Souter and the other members of the United States Supreme Court were not addressed with this issue. Mr. Old Chief's attorney did not request the remedy that we're looking for in this case. If jurors are told that a defendant, that if there's a stipulation and the prosecutor can't get into the exact nature of the underlying convictions, the jurors are still told this gentleman has two or more prior convictions, revocations, or suspensions that would be counted under 343.307 sub 1. Now, I understand what Mr. Balistrieri is going to argue. He's going to argue jurors don't know what that means. Jurors aren't going to know what revocations, suspensions, etc. are counted on under that section. But that argument fails for several reasons. First of all, everyone is presumed to know the law. Secondly, the phraseology is couched in terms of revocations or suspensions. They're also told that this issue is relevant to the defendant's driver record. I think we can assume that jurors, and I give the jurors a lot of credit, they're going to know that these revocations, convictions, or suspensions are topically related to the issue at hand.
Well, what's the matter with them knowing?
Pardon me?
What's the matter with them knowing?
The matter with them knowing, Madam Chief Justice, is that we have a long-standing tradition in this country of keeping this type of evidence from jurors. It is especially dangerous when we're talking about prior convictions in a drunk driving case that are drunk driving convictions. The temptation is overwhelming for jurors to engage in this type of propensity analysis. And if the prosecutor needs that type of evidence to gain a conviction, then perhaps the charges shouldn't have been filed in the first place.
Okay, well now suppose to keep with Justice Souter's instructions, we just say, we amend your instructions a little bit and say, because of the defendant's record, or because of the defendant's prior convictions, the applicable concentration in this case is 0.08. What about that?
That's exactly what happened in this case.
Well, no, they use the words revocation and suspensions.
Well,
I'm going to eliminate that. I'm going to eliminate the citation to the statute. I mean, I'm trying to fit this within what Souter said.
Despite that effort, bells and whistles and red lights are still going to be going off in these jurors' minds that, hey, there's something wrong with this guy's past. That's why they're making such a big stink over this alcohol level being applicable to him. Why not eliminate all the bells, whistles, and red lights altogether and simply tell the jurors, look, you've taken an oath to apply the law. The law in this case says that the limit you must apply to this gentleman or this lady is 0.08. If they're told that, they're never going to wonder.
Well, but you got a cautionary instruction. And Judge Fine explained, and our court has said a lot of times, cautionary instruction is good enough. And as he explained in footnote 3, this is a pragmatic rule, that is, that the cautionary instruction will be obeyed. And it is rooted less in the absolute certitude that the presumption is true than in the belief that it represents a reasonable practical accommodation of the interests of the state and the defendant, citing a U.S. Supreme Court case. Well, maybe we have to make an accommodation between the defendant and the state here, and make an accommodation similar to the one that the trial judge did, or similar to the one I just stated.
I'll be honest with you, Madam Chief Justice. I think the cautionary instruction actually adds fuel to the fire because it draws a link between the statement that is given to the jury that this gentleman has two or more prior revocations, convictions or suspensions under 343-307 sub 1, and tells the jurors in no uncertain terms that that evidence is relevant to the defendant's driving record.
Let me ask you, did the defense, and I don't know whether you tried this case, but did the defense ask for the cautionary instruction, or did the trial judge make an offer to do it or not do it, dependent on the defendant's position?
Well, initially it would have been the trial, and I didn't try the case, but another attorney from the firm did, and I know that he initially wanted to avoid the problem altogether and move to the unilateral jury waiver. Judge Dugan denied that, and I believe there was a cautionary instruction read to the jury, but there are several problems with the cautionary
instruction. And my question is, then when the ruling was made that the jury was going to get at least the limited information, did the judge... Was an objection by the defense to accompany... You're arguing that the cautionary instruction created more of a problem, and my question is whether the defense objected to the giving of the cautionary on top of what had already been the ruling.
I don't believe it did, and to be honest with you, I think it puts the defense practitioner in very much of a catch-22 situation, because you want the cautionary instruction to the extent that it tells the jurors they're not to use this evidence for any other purpose, but you don't want the cautionary instruction because it also draws the link between this evidence and the defendant's driver record. I believe in this context, a cautionary instruction is the equivalent of putting a Band-Aid on a shotgun blast to the chest. It just doesn't go far enough. It doesn't stop the bleeding. And in fact, if you read the jury instruction committee's comments, they have a lengthy introduction to this section of the jury instructions. If you read their comments, you will find that the committee struggled mightily. In fact, those are their words. They struggled extensively with determining whether or not this type of information, which they acknowledged was extremely prejudicial, should go to the jurors. Ultimately, they concluded, however, that they were bound by the clear language of the statute, and the clear language of the statute seemed to indicate that that is an element of the offense for the jurors' consideration.
Mr. Malosky, let's talk about this particular case for a couple minutes. It's my understanding that the jury was told that .08 is what applied. The evidence showed that your client was .24. Now, under those circumstances, even if we concede there was error, how do you get around the harmless error rule in this case?
Well, I anticipated that argument and prepared for it, and I will start by saying that when applying the harmless error analysis, first of all, it's the burden of the party to whom the error was a benefit, in this case, the state, to demonstrate why it is not, or why it is harmless error. So I don't know that I'm in the position to justify that issue. Secondly, I think there are certain pieces of evidence. There are certain situations that are so flammable, that are so prejudicial, that they have to be presumed to be something other than harmless error if the jurors are allowed to consider them. We'll never know. We'll never be able to climb into these jurors' heads and find out exactly what they were thinking, whether or not this gentleman's prior record came into play at all.
Well, let me ask you, what was the defense during the trial? I mean, what was the theory of the defense in defending this?
Well, Your Honor, there were several theories of defense. First of all, there was a pretrial motion seeking suppression of the intoxilizer result.
But once you got to the jury and they were hearing the intoxilizer, other than preserving all this for appellate purposes, what was the theory of the defense before the jury? What else? If the jury had not heard about the prior convictions, they heard about this 0.24 or whatever the number was, and they heard about, I assume, some driving. What did they hear that might have given them reasonable doubt?
To be honest with you, I'm not positive on that fact, but I believe that it was a claim of chemical interference. But I would have to review the trial record more closely to determine that for sure.
In the Court of Appeals decision, there's a discussion of the theory of defense instruction. And Alexander complains that the trial court did not give a special theory of defense instruction. I'm assuming that that meant there was a theory of defense, and that the theory is, the theory of defense was, :1, he didn't drink enough alcohol to render him incapable of safety driving, 2, that the intoxilizer did not accurately measure his concentration because it may have measured residual mouth alcohol as opposed to deep lung alcohol, and because the machine's maintenance history raises serious doubt about its reliability and accuracy. I think that was just one, what, just three, or what?
Well, there was, and that's what I was getting to the pretrial motion, because another case that has recently been accepted by this court has to do with certain modifications that were made to the particular machine used in Mr. Alexander's case, which this court will eventually hear, and I'm sure I'll be back here arguing that issue, which is an excellent issue. And if this court affirms the Court of Appeals decision in that regard, we have a very good situation, if there's a new trial ordered in this case, to get suppression of the intoxilizer result altogether. So that's why I did begin to make mention of the pretrial motion that was involved. And again, we were thwarted to some extent because of the trial court's ruling there from going as far as we would have liked. But there are some very real defenses to the chemical test result in this case.
But your principal argument here is that the evidence of the prior convictions is so inflammatory that you just have to presume that it justifies a new trial.
Absolutely. And
yeah.
That's based almost exclusively on the reasoning of the United States Supreme Court in Old Chief. I recognize that that case is not exactly on point. The question is, does the reasoning in Old Chief justify the next logical step? Now that we can eliminate prosecutors getting into the nature and substance of the underlying OWI offense through a forced stipulation, can we then preclude evidence of that altogether through a unilateral jury waiver over the prosecutor's objection? Now, I can understand the court's concern in perhaps sailing into some uncharted waters here, but we're talking about a very narrow issue. We're not talking about justifying a defendant's right to a full jury waiver. We're not justifying a defendant's right to waiver of elements, of substantive elements. For example, if the defendant wanted to waive a finding by the jury of the intoxication element because of an operation defense, for example, that's not what we're talking about.
When you say substantive element, isn't this a substantive element of this crime? You have to, in order for your client to be convicted, they'd have to have two prior that's why it's an element of this crime.
Right, but courts have traditionally, including the United States Supreme Court in Old Chief, have drawn a distinction between substantive elements, for example, intoxication or operation in a drunk driving case, and what the court refers to as status elements. The purpose of that evidence in the OWI category is simply to determine the defendant's legal status as a two-time loser in the drunk driving game.
Let me ask you, if we agree with your position in this case, would this case also stand for the proposition that in a felon in possession of firearm case in Wisconsin, that if a defendant stipulates and agrees that he is a felon under the statute, that the only issue a jury would determine is whether a defendant is in possession of a firearm?
I think it has to. Because for the same reasons that are addressed here, when we're talking about telling jurors that this gentleman has prior felony convictions as opposed to prior OWI convictions, you get into the same problem.
Is it
your position that it's all prior convictions, regardless of the nature, that should be kept from the jury?
Well, I think ultimately it's got to be a case-by-case analysis, but particularly in cases, and this was what the Supreme Court talked about in Especially Obvious Danger, particularly in cases where the prior offenses are identical to...
How about only in cases?
Well, if that were the remedy that this court crafted as a result of this case, I think that would be perfectly acceptable.
One of the problems I'm having is this court's acknowledgement that evidence of prior convictions is acceptable under 906.09. Have you been convicted of a crime? If the defendant takes the stand, how many cases do we have that say that's fine? You can ask that question with regard to examination of the accused.
Well, ultimately, there are ways that the defendant can, through trial strategy and maneuvering, keep that evidence from the jury.
By not testifying.
By not testifying.
But if the defendant takes the stand, that
testimony is fair game. In fact, it's routine.
It is fair game. In that narrow context, it is clearly fair game. But again...
And by allowing that, we have implicitly determined that evidence of prior conviction is not so inflammatory.
Well, it's...
to deny a fair trial.
In those cases, however, it goes only to the credibility of the particular individual who takes the stand. In this particular case, it's tied to an element of the offense, which I think creates a particular danger of inflammation.
But in those hearings, we hear the same argument as trial judges you're making now. Okay, judge, it only goes to the credibility. But in reality, if they know the defendant has been previously convicted of a crime, the jury is going to use that to show that he acted in conformity this time as he's a bad character, that he's previously violated the law, and they're going to use that to show to infer that he violated the law in the case at hand.
Well, you make a good point, but I don't think it's exactly the same situation as we have here, because it's not tied to an element of the offense. The jurors are only told generally about a crime. They're not told that it's tied to the defendant's driving record, that it's counted as a revocation or suspension under 343.307, and it's not similar to or identical to the overlying offense because the jurors are never told the nature of the offense. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Balestrieri, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, I think what we have to keep in mind here is that this court is not writing on a clean slate in this case. There is a body of law that establishes certain fundamental principles that guide the court's decision here. Perhaps the most fundamental of those principles is the well-established rule that a defendant is not entitled to a perfect trial. He's only entitled to a fair trial. He is not entitled to have the state or the courts bend over backwards to give him every conceivable opportunity for acquittal. What he is entitled to is to have the courts make a ruling that creates a situation where his conviction is achieved fairly. And that's what we have to determine in this case. What is fair? And again, I'm sorry, is it...
Your principal argument, then, is harmless error?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
There's no error. I have never argued harmless error in this case. You will not find those words in my brief.
All right.
You will find in my brief several times the words, there is no error.
I just wanted to know, when you talk about fair trial, whether you're conceding that there was error. So, okay, there's no error.
There is no error.
All right, just want to get that out of the way.
Okay. Secondly, to be a little more specific, another of the fundamental principles that we're dealing with in this case is that a criminal defendant is entitled to a trial by jury. That is the preferred method of trial in criminal cases. The Constitution of the United States, the Constitution of the State of Wisconsin, guarantees a defendant a right to trial by jury. There is no constitutional right to a trial by a court. That is clearly established by decisions of the United States Supreme Court.
If the defendant wants a trial by judge, the state can say, no, we want a trial by jury, and there's a trial by jury. Is that right?
In most circumstances, yes.
Okay.
Now, in Singer versus United States, which is the case of the United States Supreme Court that established the principle that a defendant has no right to a bench trial, the court in dictum stated that there might be some circumstances in which the defendant's right to a fair trial would be so compromised by having a jury decide his case that fairness, fundamental principles of due process, require that he be able to waive this jury trial and have a trial by a court, even though the prosecutor objects. One is very hard-pressed to find any cases of any court in the 30 years since Singer was decided that take this dictum of the United States Supreme Court and establish it as a principle of law. one is even more hard-pressed to find any cases of any court in any jurisdiction which stand for the proposition that in a particular set of circumstances, there is such a danger of prejudice if the case is tried to the jury.
But Mr. Balestrieri, the defense here is not asking to waive a jury trial or saying that he's got a right to waive a jury trial. He's saying that as to one of the elements, he's saying this is essentially a status element. It doesn't go to the substantive elements of the crime. And therefore, he hasn't said this, but as I think it through, he's essentially saying this should be dealt with like a repeater charge. You don't have, if you charge a defendant as being a repeater, the jury doesn't have to find that the defendant has the status of being a repeater. That can be stipulated to by the defendant, as you well know, and the jury never even hears about a prior crime unless he happens to take the stand, and then even then he doesn't know the nature or the name of the conviction. The jury does not. So let's cut right to the heart of it. I think that at least that's how I perceive this case, whether or not the defendant has a right to keep this knowledge from the jury.
Only
the status element.
Only if presenting that evidence to the jury would so compromise his right to a fair trial that he can override the prosecutor's objection. And that's my basic point. We're not talking here about what's more fair or what's less fair. The issue here, applying the substantive fundamental principles of law, is he has only got a right on one element, on any element. He has no right to do this unless it is so prejudicial that he cannot get a fair trial in front of the jury.
Mr. Balestrieri, let me ask you about that point. Would you concede that if that were not an element, the prior convictions, that those prior convictions, as presented to the jury, would be inadmissible in the rest of the trial?
Well, I can't concede that as a general proposition because there might be circumstances in which...
In this trial. Let's talk about this trial.
As far as I know, the facts in this trial, probably, because I don't know of any circumstances in which this would come within the exceptions of the other acts.
So it would be inadmissible, A, probably because it's not probative of any issues, and even if there was some probative value, the unfair prejudice of introducing the other convictions far outweighs the probative value.
In this case, yes, but there might be other cases
in which
that would not.
Okay, well, let's talk about this case. So unlike a lot of cases where you've got elements that are clearly intertwined and evidence is admissible, maybe admissible on one element, but has probative value in explaining things on other elements, here we've got an isolated element that in fact, the evidence to prove that element is inadmissible in the trial, but for the existence of that being an element in that case.
In this case, I would say that's true. Mm-hmm.
So then the issue becomes, the inadmissibility, the unfairness of admitting that evidence when it may clearly unfairly prejudice the jury on the other elements, is that kind of unfairness that you're talking about? I mean, isn't that sort of the meat of the issue?
If that's the first question you want to ask, assuming that we actually presented evidence of the prior drunk driving convictions, which I hasten to point out was not done in this case. But assuming that we do it, there is a body of case law out there that says specifically that is not so prejudicial that it would warrant a defendant overriding the prosecutor's refusal to waive a jury.
Well, let me ask you about this waiver of jury, because I have a problem with this concept. It seems to me that when you're talking about the state's statutory right to refuse to waive a jury, the issue is waive a jury versus what? And waive a jury is usually versus a court trial, right? If you don't stipulate or agree to a waiver of jury, you have a court trial.
Right.
The defendant's not asking for a court trial on that element, is he? I mean, he was admitting to it. I mean, you can't have a guilty plea to an element, but he's stipulating, he's agreeing to it. He's not asking that the trial court, that the takeaway from the jury and give to a trial court the determination of whether he's been validly convicted. He's agreeing to it. So it seems to me that this isn't a waiver of jury issue.
Well, yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Why is that?
It is because the state has an obligation to present to the jury and to have the jury find every element of the offense.
What authority do you have that says that the state has a right to have a jury determination on an element that the defendant is conceding?
Actually, I have only cited one case in my brief that specifically stands for that proposition. That's the Schilling case out of Ohio. This issue of a partial jury waiver has not arisen very often, and I have not found very many cases that specifically deal with it, but I have found one.
Because don't jury waivers, I mean, isn't it usually jury waiver versus court trial? I mean, isn't that what we're talking about when we say a jury waiver?
Well, you still have to have a finding of that element by somebody.
But it's not contested.
Whether it's contested or not.
Well, you mean on a guilty plea that if a defendant decides to plead guilty and waive his right to a jury and admits to the elements, and although the trial court has to find there's a sufficient factual basis, the state can say, no, we want to have a jury trial. We're not waiving our right to a jury. I don't care if he wants to plead guilty. We want to prove all these elements to a jury.
As a matter of fact, yes, the state can do that.
So,
the defendant has no right to plead guilty. And the state can object to the guilty plea, and if the court, in its discretion, decides not to accept it, it goes to a jury trial.
Well, is it the court's discretion?
Yes, it's the court's discretion.
So the state doesn't have to waive the jury.
No, it's not. It's not the absolute veto that the state has in this case, but the state can still object to a guilty.
The state can force the defendant to go through a jury trial, despite the fact that he wants to plead guilty to each and every element of the offense. With no concessions, and you can force the defendant to have to go through a trial.
Yes, that's correct.
I want to comment this a little differently. The other crimes evidence here, I think you'll agree, is not admissible except on this one element of prior crimes.
In this case, right.
We're only talking about this case. And I wonder if you will agree that if admitted, even with a cautionary instruction, that there may be, I'm going to put it very lightly, it may influence a jury. That is to think that, well, if he was drunk driving two times or four times or eight times or whatever, it's possible that he's going to be drunk this time. Right? I mean, we all think that way, don't we?
That's the reason for the other acts evidence rule.
Okay. So, you have to concede, I think, that it is prejudicial evidence under the rules, meaning that it's extraneous to the finding on the other elements.
The other elements, yes.
Okay.
Not this particular element.
Not this element, right. Okay, so now that we've got that, so it seems to me that when you get a stipulation or admission on the only element for which this other crime evidence is relevant, and we agree that it is potentially prejudicial on the other elements, seems to me that under those circumstances, the defendant ought to be able to, and the state ought to concede that element and say, okay, we go on the others. You agree as to the number of convictions, right? There's no question about that. And the dates, right? Here?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So for what purpose, other than prejudice, does the state want to admit this evidence? For what purpose,
I think,
other than prejudice, does the state fail to stipulate?
You're buying into an argument that the defendant has made that I think is one that doesn't fit, or at least you're reiterating an argument that I think doesn't fit this case. I repeat, there was no evidence introduced in this case.
Okay, you're right. Let us say there was evidence introduced. Let's take it one step at a time. Let's say that the prior conviction.
Are we assuming here that the defendant did not ask for a stipulation?
No, I'm assuming all the facts the same, but now you introduce evidence. I'm going to take you step by step.
Okay, we're assuming that the defendant has offered to stipulate.
Right, you refuse. It's like McAllister.
That the state refuses to stipulate.
Right.
Okay.
Like McAllister.
So obviously error under McAllister.
But it's wrong for
yes.
you to refuse. Okay.
Yes.
So you would have no right to refuse to stipulate.
Under McAllister, no.
Okay. Now I'm going to take you to this case. Your position in this case, then, is, as I understand it, the state would have had to stipulate under McAllister, but that the state has a right to instruction that names, as it did here, that the prior convictions were for suspension and revocation. Is that right?
No, not necessarily.
Okay.
Not necessarily. What I'm suggesting is that the state has a right to have the jury instructed on an element of the offense. I am not wedded to the instruction that was given in this case.
Okay, what instruction would you be wedded to?
I would not be wedded to anyone in particular.
All right, give us one that you like, that your fiancé.
I like the instruction that was given in this case. I don't think there was anything wrong with the instruction that was given in this case. I don't think there was anything wrong with the stipulation that was given in this case. And I point out that defense counsel who tried this case expressly approved both the language of the stipulation and the language of the instructions in this case.
Let's get away from talk of rights and all that, because we're going to establish the rights in this case. Why do you want to put this in, other than for purposes of prejudice?
Now, put this in, and I respond to you, Justice Babbage, by saying, what is this? And this is part of what I was saying to Justice Abrams.
Why do you want to put in this stipulation that was read to the jury for any other purpose than prejudice?
It doesn't prejudice the jury. There is no prejudice.
Why do you want to inform the jury that he was convicted other than for purposes of prejudice? I'm going to get you to answer that question one of these minutes.
You will get me to answer. But I want to set up the context.
It any way you want, Mr. Balistrieri, but you obviously know what I'm getting at.
I know what you're getting at, and I want to set up the context of this answer that we have to make sure that we keep in mind that we're talking about here about a very innocuous stipulation. That while it does tell the jury that there have been prior convictions, revocations, or suspensions, does not tell them the nature of those prior convictions, revocations, or suspensions. Now, why do we want to get that in? We want to get that in because, as was discussed at some length by the United States Supreme Court in Old Chief, and as we all know from our own experience as attorneys, trying cases or judging cases on appeal, seeing cases on appeal, what happens? Jurors are not totally ignorant of the law. They're not, by the way, they are not presumed to know the law. That's an incorrect presumption. That presumption applies to criminal defendants, and it's a presumption of law, not a presumption of fact. We don't presume that anybody actually knows the law. It's just a corollary to the proposition that ignorance of the law is no excuse. But I digress. But at any rate, jurors come with certain knowledge of the law. Now, maybe not every person who serves as a juror in a drunk driving case in this state knows that the usual blood alcohol prohibited level is 0.10. But a lot of them do. It's very common knowledge that 0.10 is the usual prohibited blood alcohol level. So you get a guy coming in into court, and the jury is told, you can convict him if he has 0.08. That's 20% less than the 0.10. That's usual. Well, if they're not given some explanation of why, in this particular case, they can convict someone of drunk driving if he's driving with 0.08 in his blood instead of the usual 0.10, all sorts of strange things can happen. A juror can think, well, they've made some kind of mistake here. They said 0.08 when they really meant 0.10. Or they can think, oh, they're really coming down on this poor guy. Why are they coming down on him? They're being very unfair to him.
Mr. Balistrieri, that can be remedied by the discussion that I had with petitioner's counsel here. Can it not? Can't the court simply say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you know, in the course of voir dire, I heard many of you thought you knew what the legal limit is. There are a number of legal limits. For purposes of this case, we've the limit is, and you, is there anybody here who feels they can't follow the law? I mean, that's done all the time when there may be exceptions.
I know it, but we all have our experiences, and I have my own personal experiences.
Is this a proper purpose to admit it? Now, let's assume for a moment this is inadmissible evidence, and I know that you're not going to concede that. Inadmissible evidence to hopefully, sort of behind the closed doors of the jury, assure them that it's okay in this case to use a lower limit? I mean, it seems to me you're making an argument that you're not going to tell, you don't want to tell the juries, look, he's been convicted of OWI twice before, and therefore there's a lower limit. We can't do that. So you want to inferentially do that in hopes that they'll get the message. I mean, it seems to me that's the gist of your argument.
But no, it isn't. It doesn't inferentially do that. It doesn't tell them.
Well, what does it do?
It doesn't tell them that he's got prior drunk driving convictions.
What does it tell them?
It tells them that there's a reason.
And what do you think?
Some reason.
Okay, what do you think a reasonable juror thinks the reason is for lowering the legal limit for an adult person might be when they told that there are two convictions, suspensions, or revocations? I mean, what is the reason?
As I told Justice Abrahamson, I'm not wedded to the notion of telling them that there are two prior convictions.
Well, what could we tell the jury of why there's a .08 here without telling them that there are convictions, suspensions, or revocations?
It is, I will again repeat, I don't think there's anything wrong with telling them that. But if you want to be even more cautious and explain to the jury why it's .08 instead of .10 without saying that there are prior revocations, convictions, or suspensions, you can simply instruct the jury that the second element of the offense requires that there be certain circumstances, without going further into what those circumstances are, which make it unlawful for a particular person to drive with a blood alcohol concentration of 0.08 rather than 0.10. And then you can instruct the jury, assuming there's been a stipulation to that effect, you can instruct the jury that there has been a stipulation between the parties that those circumstances exist in this case, and therefore it was unlawful for the defendant to drive if he had a blood alcohol concentration of 0.08.
Why is that any different than saying there are a number of limits in the law, ladies and gentlemen, and in this case, I'm telling you that this is the limit?
Sorry, I didn't quite get your question.
Just simply for the court, as we do with all instructions, saying there are a number, the law varies, and in this case, the rule of the law that I'm giving you in this case is that the defendant was prohibited in driving in excess of .08. Why do you have to say there's circumstances out there?
Because
you just tell the jury what the law
because
is.
Because there are jurors who might, or it's a possibility that there are jurors who might feel that the state is being unfair in charging the defendant.
Okay. So we can modify it. You'll accept maybe a modification that says, and the parties, including the state and the defendant, have agreed because of circumstances in this case, .08 is applicable. Okay, now we're being fair to the state. Okay?
As long as we advise them that there is a good reason in this case other than discrimination against this poor defendant.
Yeah, we can even say, and the state's not discriminating against this defendant, just applying the general rules applicable to all defendants that would be like Mr. Alexander. How's that?
I'm sure we could come up with some kind of wording that would be fair.
And
to
we everybody. Can avoid revocation and suspension language. Okay. Sounds to me like you're awfully close to the defendant here.
Well, I don't think so.
All right.
Because he says he can waive the jury. I say we can't.
Well, we just agreed that you're going to accept Justice Geske's instructions to the jury that maybe somewhat amended. I'm not going to bind her to my suggestions. And that you'll go to the jury that way?
Well, I'm willing to go to the jury that way, but I still want to go to the jury. I still want to advise the jury of all of the elements of the offense. I mean, I'm willing to make some accommodations on the language that the jury is given, but I insist that we have a right to go to the jury on that element.
So you don't accept Justice Geske's instruction plus
I do accept some form of an instruction.
What do you mean, go to the jury?
Yeah.
I don't understand that. What is your bottom line? What must the jury be told if you go to the jury?
The jury must be told that one of the elements of the offense is that, put in its most generic form, that there are some circumstances under which it is unlawful for a defendant to drive with a blood alcohol concentration of 0.08. The jury has to be instructed on that element of the offense. Unless a defendant is deprived of a fair trial by telling the jury that.
Well, let me ask you.
The case law is absolutely to the contrary, including the case on which the defendant relies, Olchi, which says in no uncertain terms that if you instruct the jury generically that the defendant has the kind of convictions which are necessary to meet the elements of the offense without specifying the name or nature of the convictions, that's enough to eliminate the prejudice.
Well, Mr. Ballstreet, you keep telling this court, at least implicitly, that you're not fighting this hard because you want to prejudice the defense. You're fighting this hard because you simply want to go to the jury.
I want to maintain the state's right to have a jury trial. That's why I'm fighting hard.
A jury trial? You've got a jury trial.
On every element of the offense.
We're talking about a status element.
I'm talking about any element.
But McAllister says, and you don't fight that, McAllister says you've got to stipulate.
Says you've got to stipulate, but it also says that when you stipulate, the stipulation is read to the jury.
And see, the jury is told, is the jury told that despite the stipulation, they still have to find beyond a reasonable doubt the defendant was convicted of two applicable convictions, suspensions, revocations? And explain what that means? I mean, if the jury still has to make that determination, despite an agreement that may be read to the jury, are they told what it is they have to find beyond a reasonable doubt for that element?
Well, they're told by the stipulation that what they have to find is what is...
Well, you can't direct the jury to find anything, can you, in a criminal case?
I'm sorry, you can't...
You can't direct a jury. I mean,
no.
If it's going to the jury, this jury could, despite stipulations, they could set it aside and not find that element beyond a reasonable doubt.
No, you don't direct a verdict, but there's language in the pattern instructions that tells the jury what they're supposed to do with stipulations, how they're supposed to consider them in terms of being
They could disregard it if they wanted.
They could. That's the problem.
But the state wants that option. You want the jury to make a determination up and above the agreement with the defendant. You want the jury to decide whether you have satisfied them beyond a reasonable doubt that he was convicted of the appropriate convictions, suspensions, or revocations.
Well, as I said,
that's what going to the jury means, right, is they have them decide that element.
They have to decide the element. I am willing to make some accommodations on how that element is explained to the jury.
But the circumstances, if you tell them there's an agreement as to some circumstances, what are you telling them they must find beyond a reasonable doubt as to that third element?
That the circumstances which reduce the prohibited blood alcohol from 0.10 to 0.08 exist in this case.
I hear you arguing two different things. I hear you arguing that you want a jury trial on all elements. You've said that.
Yes, I did.
But then I also hear you saying... It's almost as though there's the status condition that the jury has to be advised of. That is, the jury has a right to be advised of the element. I think of this like the old Chief case. There is, to me, some merit in the argument that in a felon charge, possession of a weapon, there has to be an acknowledgement that the condition of felon is met. If you only advise the jury, this guy is charged with possessing a weapon, a jury in Wisconsin would say, you know, are you crazy for charging someone with the possession of a weapon? So sometimes the preceding element has to be, the jury has to be advised of that. But you seem to be saying that in one sense, they have to be advised that the preceding element has been fulfilled, has been stipulated to. And then you also seem to be saying, and I want the jury to be instructed on all elements so they can decide all elements. Which are you saying?
I'm saying both.
Oh, that's what I thought.
I'm saying that the jury has to be instructed on all of the elements of the offense. But they can also be instructed that there is a stipulation regarding the facts that are relevant to establishing that element of the offense. And the pattern instruction tells the jury how they're supposed to deal with a stipulation.
What does the pattern instruction say?
I mean, it's basically that there has been a stipulation, and the stipulation is sufficient to establish the element of the offense. I'm paraphrasing
here. Okay, and so the jury comes back with a question to the judge saying, we're not so sure that the circumstances exist or that we accept the stipulation. Do we have to accept the stipulation? What's your answer?
Does the jury have to accept the stipulation? No, the jury does not accept the stipulation.
Well, doesn't the pattern instruction advise them that that is, and you are to accept that as true? That's what the pattern instruction
says. Well, it says that you have to accept it as true, yeah, but they don't have, but...
It tells them they have to, but, I recall.
Yeah, essentially it tells them that they have to, but juries can come back with verdicts that are contrary to what they're instructed.
That may be, and in a criminal case, you might not be able to do anything about it.
And you can't do anything in a criminal case.
But the law is that they have to accept the jury instruction.
Can I ask a question?
Go ahead.
Well, in a criminal case, when you charge a defendant as being a repeater, you readily concede, do you not, that that evidence of prior conviction does not go to the jury?
No.
To establish that.
No.
How is this any different other than that the legislature set it up?
Well, I think you dealt with that issue, although somewhat tangentially, in the case you decided last term, State versus Weideman, which was a case that was brought under the subdivision A of the statute. The defendant was charged with operating while under the influence of an intoxicant, and you held there, quite correctly, that having a prior conviction was not an element of that offense. It was only an element of the penalty enhancer, and therefore there was no need for the state to prove that in the trials. They could just prove it when the judge considered the penalty. And then in a footnote, you said, compare Ludeking, which is this case, the case charged under sub B with having a prohibited alcohol content, where under Ludeking, the fact that the defendant has two or more prior convictions doesn't just go to the penalty. It's not a penalty enhancer. It's a substantive element of the offense itself. That's the difference. And where it's a substantive element of the offense as opposed to just an element of the penalty enhancer, it's something that has to be considered by the jury, not just by the judge in imposing the penalty. It has to be considered by the jury in determining guilt.
Maybe we should reinterpret that statute for another day, Mr. Balistrain. Thank you, Mr. Balistrain. Mr. Milowski, you have 5 minutes. Yes. Oh, before you begin, the students here are welcome to meet with Justice Steinmetz. I think we're going to meet right after this oral argument. Okay? And he will meet you right here in the conference room in about 6 or 7 minutes from now. Mr. Milowski.
Thank you. Just for clarification, the stipulation instruction is Wisconsin Jury Instruction Criminal 162, and it states that, this is what the judge reads to the jury, quote, the parties have stipulated or agreed to the existence of certain facts, and you must accept these facts as conclusively proved. That's the exact reading of jury instruction 162. The state can get up here and piously intone that the need for the full breadth of the drunk driving charge in a third or subsequent case is the need for evidentiary depth, that jurors are going to be kept guessing as to why a .08 standard is applicable into this particular case. It's important to note that the Supreme Court in Old Chief flatly rejected this line of reasoning. This is the same argument that the United States made in Old Chief. And I will quote from Old Chief, this recognition that the prosecution, with its burden of persuasion, needs evidentiary depth to tell a continuous story, has, however, virtually no application when the point at issue is a defendant's legal status dependent on some judgment rendered wholly independently of the concrete events of later criminal behavior charged against him. As in this case, the choice of evidence for such an element is usually not between eventful narrative and abstract proposition, but between propositions of slightly varying abstraction. So the all-too-familiar prosecutorial battle cry that we get to prove our case our own way, we can do whatever we want to prove our elements the way we want to prove them, and the defendant cannot stipulate, waive, or admit out the full force of our evidentiary case against him, has no place in this situation.
In this situation.
You
recognize or concede anyway that there might be some instances in which status does play a part in filling out the hole.
In this particular context of an OWI third or subsequent offender, this reasoning has no place. Tell the jurors, the state puts it as courts shouldn't be bending over backwards to accommodate defendants. Is it bending over backwards to tell the jurors, listen people, it's .08, that's the limit applicable to this guy, and if you don't apply it to him, you're violating your oath? How much of an inconvenience is that for courts to accommodate the prejudicial and highly inflammatory...